You're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. I'm your host for this week's segment, Ann Nicholson Weber. And I'm talking today to David Cromer, who is directing William Inge's Come Back, Little Sheba for Shattered Globe Theater, which is now playing at Victory Gardens. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me, David.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely.
I wonder if you could start by telling me how you and Shattered Globe connected to hook up to do this particular play.
We've known each other in bars for years and years and years. For as long as they've been around, I've seen them in bars. Generally at Sturges. So I've known them a long time, and we talk every year practically about doing a show. And it just never works out timing-wise or idea-wise, and it finally did. And this is I have this sort of very small pile of plays, many of which I've managed to get done, so I don't know what I'm going to do now, that I spend years and years and years, and every time someone says, hey, you know, I'll have like a success, I'll have like Angels in America or something like that will happen, I'll have something that people like, and I get a million calls, and everyone says, hey, why don't you come in, and we'll what do you want to do? We'd love to work with you. What do you want to do? And I say, well, I'd like to do Come Back, Little Sheba, you know, or I'd like to do Journey's End, and they tend to be these sort of perceived of as older, creaky plays, or they're a little obscure, or they don't seem particularly hip, and it's because they're not. And people, you know, they say, oh, anything you want to do? And I say, I want to do Come Back, Little Sheba. And they go,
kind of a dead silence.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, no. So a lot of those deals never work out. Sheba was one I had almost figured out how to do it. I was almost worked out to do it at several theaters. And there was just always these complications, these huge complications, that sort of don't make sense, but that happened anyway, despite the goodwill of all involved, that prevented it from happening to the point where I was going to do it at one theater, and then we weren't, and it was gone, and then someone else had the right. So after years of struggle trying to get it, I had lost access to it. I had lost, you know, it wasn't my deal anymore, and that was really sad, and I was sort of mourning that, and then I just got an email from Brian Pudel after 10 years of this and never getting access to it. Just an email from Brian Pudel saying, hey, we're doing a play called Come Back, Little Sheba. Do you want to direct it? So it was like, oh my God. It was, yes. You know, you type a Y so you can send it faster. And that story doesn't have an end, except that the show opened last Sunday. So that's the end of the story. That is the end of the story.
It's a very good end.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting you went right to your interest in shows that aren't hip, that are sort of dowdy, you might say. And that's something that interests me very much to talk about with this play. It sounds like you have a general interest in plays like that. Mm. My question was going to be, what sets this play above other plays of its era? Is there something that you think makes it last better?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's a generally understood concept of peeling back the seamy underbelly of the 50s America or the American dream and stuff like that, and it tends to be a lot more kind of flashy, and there's a million things like that. Come Back, Little Sheba is such a teeny, 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 tiny play, and I mean that in the best possible sense. It's so small, and it's about I think it sets it apart because the thing it reveals is something that I think feels very, very private to people. Mm-hmm. Like, and it is the humiliation that you're not really allowed to talk about that is getting older. And I know that kind of idea which should send people flocking to the theater. but I think that's a private thing. That people don't feel comfortable sort of whining about to each other. But I think a lot of people have it. And the people I talk to, and you and I were talking before we started about just the little things about our eyesight not being as strong as it used to be. And I was going to say that a colleague of mine at Columbia, a director named Susan Padveen. Do you know Susan Padveen?
No.
She and I were talking. My wrists were hurting all last year. I was going to say, you know, we're in our 40s. So we're talking about like, I went to the doctor. She goes, yeah, you know, now we're at this age now where you go to the doctor and you say, yeah, my wrists hurt. And they go, yeah.
Sorry.
That's going to be like that or get worse for the rest of your life.
Right, right.
You know, and I don't just mean infirmity because I don't think that that's necessarily what the play's about, but just a little. And I think that the very small shame of being sort of marginalized as you get older. So I think that that's something that isn't, I think it's talked about in very broad terms and in very flashy terms by, like, they have people with too much plastic surgery on a television show or something like that. But just the day-to-day kind of, just the little murder that is, I'm not in that race anymore,
mm-hmm.
can be very, very sad. And I, if since theater is a communal experience, still is, and maybe one of the few, to go in a room and experience something that feels like it might be something that you maybe shouldn't be allowed to worry about, mm-hmm. or it is unseemly to worry about, or to be sad about, to be kind of marginalized a little bit as you get older, particularly since they have all this sort of youth and exuberance in front of them. And so I think ultimately that has value. I always think that has value, that if you can say, this is something that everybody thinks that you might not think everybody thinks, or that mm-hmm. you might think is only you,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I always think that's valuable. So I don't mean to make theater as support group, but William Inge was not saved by, but he was helped a great deal by Alcoholics Anonymous throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
He never got a hold of his drinking, but he could get a hold of it for periods of time. And I really think the serenity prayer that's overtly stated at the beginning of the play, and that most people kind of know now that Alcoholics Anonymous is so prevalent in our culture, but it's grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom always to know the difference. Now that's it. You can know that and you can write it down, but the process of doing it
mm-hmm.
is a complicated and ongoing struggle, you know? And that happens when you're producing theater. You know, there's things you can't change, and then there's things you can change, and then you're going to have to, if you don't, can't tell the difference, you're going to have a very long tech.
Right.
As they say. So this one is a very small, very private, almost shameful, almost shameful self-doubt and fear sort of laid bare. And I appreciate that. And I appreciate that in a play. It's not a big idea. It's a little tiny idea, but it's a little tiny idea that's with us a lot more than whether the American dream is flawed
mm-hmm.
necessarily, because it's what we have when we're puttering around the house all morning, not wanting to do the dishes, which is, you know,
a lovely
the story scene. Of my life.
Right. And Lola's.
Yeah, and Lola's.
Well, I think you may have answered a question that I was going to ask, which is, you were quoted in performing, you did an interview with Carrie Kaufman
mm-hmm.
way back, and you said, there's some kind of first impulse, an image, a picture, a sound, or even mm-hmm. a space, something that pops into my head, and I try to build things on that.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Was there,
well, that stuff comes back to bite you, doesn't it?
Well, do you know, was there such a germ for this?
Yes. And you know what? It was probably Turk posing.
Hmm.
It's this thing, there's this kind of eroticism, there's all this flesh in this dingy room
mm-hmm.
with this woman who lost the thing that made her most valuable, I guess, to the world, which was that it's alluded to that she was so beautiful,
mm-hmm.
was so just this peach, you know?
Right.
And so I think it was that. I think it was the juxtaposition of the lonely person, the messy house, and the half-naked guy in the house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that seemed so sudden to me. It's also the climax of the other thing that's the first impulse, which is how long she's home in the morning with seemingly nothing happening. I think that is a stunning piece of writing
mm-hmm.
and a really unbelievably bold piece of writing. And that's one of the things about this play way bolder than people even realize, that he puts what is close to 20 minutes of her sitting around the house looking for something to do. Now, this is going to send people racing to the box office, but, and I don't know how you feel about this, but it's really carefully crafted to reflect the time-killing process that people go through, and also how she tries to get everyone who happens to chance by the house to talk to her.
Right. That feeling of claustrophobia is very strong.
Yeah.
Her, just how shuttered in she is. And I think it does, there is a little bit of the way it communicates is by making us bored and antsy too. I mean, I did have that experience through that some of that scene, that it was like, oh, come on, when's something going to happen? And my experience of it was then that contributed to the payoff as the play went along.
And that's one of the things that's sort of great about the writing. I mean, I think that the idea of the missing dog, I always think that his symbols like that, like this little Sheba is her dog, and her dog is lost at the beginning of the play. And she goes out on the porch, for those of you who haven't seen it yet, and she calls to the dog. And so that's repeated, you know, that come back, little Sheba, come back, little Sheba, come back. And she talks about her cute little puppy. And while that seems like it's a little overt in its symbolism, I think that that's what's sort of theatrical about it. In the middle of its naturalism, which is that he tied that everything feeds the thesis, which is that everything feels like it's drooping and going away and narrowing, and things are being cast off till you find out sort of what you have left. It's hard. Like I had a couple of years where I had good access to projects. Like I had a lot of good jobs lined up, and then I had a couple of years where that was not the case. And just that little thing, by the way, you can't have as many things as you had last year. You go, wait, come back, little Sheba.
Yeah.
You know, and that's constant. So the Turk posing thing doesn't stop at, oh, look, there's a, you know, that she's looking at a half-naked guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's the germ of an idea is it's sort of the DNA of the whole play. And if you ask what it means, like if you say, why is this or what is this, what is it made of, it can be expanded up into the entire production, because the entire production is her sort of struggling with, well, both of them, both Doc and Lola, struggling with the narrowing of possibility, the constant narrowing of possibility. Now, that's a very, I suppose, negative way to look at things, but a lot of people look at things that way, and I guess I'm one of them, you know.
Are there ways that theme, which in your own response to the text is reflected in this production, are there things you can point to that you did because you knew that your emotional connection to the play, at least preliminarily, had been that feeling of aging and loss?
Off the top of my head, that Turk and Marie needed to not have a mark on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the actress playing Turk and Marie needed to be a certain kind of beautiful. You know, obviously they're much beyond that. I love both those performances a lot. And we saw a lot of people for that, and not for who was most beautiful, but for who was most sort of joyous and exuberant. That you have things in opposition to that. And that's tricky, because one of the things that was especially difficult, I don't want to speak for them, but what was especially difficult for me directing those actors was, to a certain extent, you have to at certain points say to them, you have a function here which is beyond you getting to play a person living their life. I hopefully tried to not get in their way while they were trying to do play a person living a life pursuing a want, but that they had to you had to kind of limit the things they could explore as actors, because it would be difficult to give those characters a lot of fears and insecurities, because mm-hmm. if they had a lot of fears and insecurities, they would not be as... they can have the fears and insecurities. We don't necessarily want to see... Doc and Lola can't see them, because if Doc and Lola see them, mm-hmm. then they go, okay, well, they're afraid and insecure too.
So it's almost
whereas
as
they need to seem... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, no. It's almost as if you're saying that we are not seeing Turk and Marie. We're seeing Turk and Marie as Lola and Doc
see them. Yeah.
So that it's not... Which is interesting, because often I've heard it said and thought, actually, that one of the things that's unique to theater is it's, or important about theater, is that it's objective in a way. Everybody mm-hmm. has their individual lives on the stage, mm-hmm. and we pick and choose how to respond. And there's almost something filmic. I suppose I'm now responding out of mm-hmm. the fact that I've just written a book about the differences between film and theater, but there's, it sounds like directorially you're putting a point of view onto the interpretation that's invisible to the audience.
Yeah.
But you're saying we're going to look at these, we're only going to let you see these characters as Lola and Doc see them.
And I actually, yes, that is the case. And I actually, that's one of the things that I don't like having to do. But every play asks you for something different.
Right.
And I think that Sheba did ask that, that Doc and Lola stay in the center, and that Turk and Marie are almost circumstances mm-hmm. that they react to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's incredibly limiting to good actors.
Yeah. Another, the young lovers, I think, have another problem, which is that I imagine, anyway, and maybe this is condescending to the audiences of the 50s, but I have to think that the cultural milieu was such that their story and their relationship was pretty racy as compared to how your audience
yeah.
is going to respond to it.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you thought about that, if you worried about that, if...
Well, again, I did. I thought things like, it is no longer shocking to us that a young woman in college has sex. Now, you know, there's even a joke about the Kinsey Report in the show. Obviously, we know that people lived their lives and behaved not wholly dissimilarly than they do now. But there was the issue of whether you talked about it or
mm-hmm,
not.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have the power that she did it. It doesn't have the power for the audience. But who it does have the power for is Doc. So as you're dealing with it now,
uh-huh.
and this is one of the things, Doc knows that Marie's dating this guy, but she also knows that he's also constructed the reality that she doesn't really like it, and he's mauling her, and I don't know why she's with her, and he's always pawing her. She probably forces her to kiss him. And then you just find out that she's fucking the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was successful or not is up to the viewer, I guess, but we tried to make it... It isn't shocking that she slept with a guy. It is horrifying to Doc.
Right. Well, talking more about the period, this is certainly in the genre of the kitchen sink drama, and you made the choice to have a kitchen sink.
Oh, boy, howdy, yeah.
Took the realistic, naturalistic yeah. setting and design to the nth degree. Was that something that you knew from the beginning you would do, or did you hesitate about it? Were there other choices you thought of?
No, I knew from the beginning. The conversations are really, you want an egg? No, coffee's fine. For pages.
Mm-hmm.
Again, really, it sounds really exciting, like you want to see it, huh?
You do want to see it.
It is a study in ordinariness, ideally.
Right.
And in what's inherently dramatic in the ordinary, in the tiny little gestures of a morning, are the huge events of your life. And I guess that's what we do anyway. That's what we do all the time. And that becomes more interesting to me. An exciting plot with bandits and shooting is a lot less interesting, you know, mm-hmm. and interesting to me now. So it requires it. You knew you had to.
Mm-hmm.
And then so you decided, why not just go the farthest you can with it? And we tried to make the light through the window is real specific, and we tried to create the illusion that everything was coming from practical sources, that you were only ever in the light. I mean, so it's the idea that you were only ever getting light through the windows or light from the lamps,
mm-hmm.
and obviously you're not, but we kind of One of the stage directions is in neighborhoods like this, the houses are built so close together that sunlight has trouble getting in. So we dealt with the idea of like how light would have to struggle to get all the way across that room, because mm-hmm. It's just such a black hole, the place. And you know, again, that's a germ of an idea that leads to everything, which leads to the idea that this house, everyone in this play, except Doc and Lola, and to a certain extent including them, is only in that house for as short a time as they can possibly manage to be there before they get the hell out.
Mm-hmm, right.
And, you know, again, I'm about to say something that really isn't going to make people want to see it, but you have to be stuck there with Doc and Lola as an audience.
Yes.
Now, again, like I keep joking that these sound unattractive. I think that they're... I like to think that it has... It's sort of interesting to watch. It's not. We didn't let it be boring. We tried to construct what the little dramas were in the middle of it.
Well, obviously the critics think that you succeeded. So
well, hopefully, yeah.
Well, one thing I'm always interested in trying to get into is process, and I thought it might be interesting to talk about a very specific staging choice you made and how it happened. There's a scene near the end when Doc comes back from having been incarcerated dried out.
Yeah.
And Lola's in the kitchen and Doc's in the living room, and between them is an arch door, not arch, but an opening. Mm-hmm. And they stay in those two spaces for a very long time, talking to each other through the door.
Yeah.
Which is obviously conveys a sense of separation.
Yeah.
At some point in the rehearsal process, you must have had to decide, first of all, to do that at all, and second of all, who's going to move into the other person's space.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just interested if you could talk about how that happens, how that's negotiated.
Well, I'm glad you noticed it, because that was something I sort of liked. For good or ill, I'm glad you noticed it, whether you liked it or because it's something that I sort of liked when I ran into. And I know it might be a little literal, but it's certainly, the play is not unliteral in its position sometimes. It just happened. I mean, I walked them in, and I had the idea on the spot, so it wasn't something I had planned too hard. But I did. It never changed. And I remember thinking when I did it, I thought like, "Oh, well, that's not bad." He said, patting himself on the back. I said, "That's not bad. That's kind of interesting. I hope I don't change that. I hope that works. I hope I keep that."
Right.
You know,
sometimes you do have to throw out
Well,
your best
sometimes
stuff.
You have to kill your babies, as they say.
Right.
You know,
but that one lasted.
Well, what I found. And then to answer the other thing is there was a point in the show where we, point in rehearsals where I looked at it and I thought, the show, and I thought, okay, I don't know what the problem is. Doc, you know what Lola's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know what Lola's going to decide. As soon as the crisis takes place. And I felt like we were playing it that way. I felt like we'd focused very hard on the crisis. And then the play goes on for quite a bit after the crisis, where you just know what Lola's going to do. And it seems very, very obvious. So I thought, okay, well, what's the problem here? And I guess I thought, is this the last time Lola can put up with this crisis?
Mm-hmm.
Is this... Because there's a line the AA sponsor, Ed Anderson, says to, played by the brilliant Carl Potthoff, says to Lola, which is, he says, he'll be back in a couple of days. I don't want to pry into personal affairs, ma'am, but he's going to need you then pretty bad. And she doesn't respond.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't answer.
Oh, I'll
and
be
in
there.
Fact, what, and in fact, she then calls and asks her parents if she can come home.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized, okay, buried in here is that we don't know that what is the play is what Lola's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So then it became the extension of that, and we didn't experiment too much with it, I will say that. It became that Doc was going to come in and stand in his position and ask her for what he's going to ask her for. I'm being so cryptic, but yeah. Anyone can put this together. and that it was going to finally be her decision. Mm-hmm. A play, and for the whole play, she has no power. Mm-hmm. For the whole play, everyone is trying to get away from her or only deal with her for as short a period of time as they can. Mm-hmm. And what happens, and the first time, certainly in the play, and maybe in many, many years, and maybe in her life, where someone said, I need your answer, and I need you to do something, mm-hmm. please, out of you have no reason to want to do this, I can only ask that you will. Mm-hmm. And that it's finally in her hands. So I guess it became that she would move. Mm-hmm. It became the case. Because he says, well, she says, of course I'll never leave you. Well, there's the ending. But it's more complicated than that. you can cut that out if you want.
I don't think we need to worry about spoilers. These are old plays.
Right, exactly. Come on, we've all seen the movie. Which I will say that I can't remember the drunk scene in the movie. I can't remember the crisis in the movie. I can remember Lola's mourning alone really clearly. I can remember, you know, all that stuff. I don't remember the second half. It doesn't stick with me, you know.
That brings us right to John Judd.
Oh, yes, it does.
Because nobody's going to forget that scene from this production. You've had a long and really wonderful collaboration with John. I first saw work that you did together with That Angels production, which, as I said before we started, The Mics Lives in Memory is one of the great top 10 shows in my lifetime. Wow. And then you, I think, maybe somewhat unexpectedly cast John as Laurence Olivier.
Yes, I did.
And
yes,
now,
I did. That made me look very smart, didn't it?
It did. It certainly did. Again, an indelible performance. What changes in the way you deal with an actor when you have that kind of history?
I don't know. I can't speak for him. I know certain things he does incredibly well, and I try to make use of them. And I also know that he likes to be given harder things to do. He won't always admit he likes to be given harder things to do, but he likes to be given harder things to do. And sometimes I sort of like, one time I had to teach an audition class, and the thing I tried to figure out about casting was that an actor needs to, what a director really wants an actor to do is solve a problem that they can't solve. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. To come in and say, not literally say, I always have to explain this to the actors, not literally say, here's how I'm going to help you, but show how I'm going to help you, because I don't know who can play this part. I don't know who's going to play this part. And that that John can always solve that problem for mm-hmm. me. So that's why I keep going back to him. I mean, it even goes to something more mundane than great admiration for his talent, which I have, and love for him as a person, which I have. But it's less work for me if I hire John.
Because you know he'll get there.
Because he's going to bring all this great stuff.
Which does raise the question why you haven't joined a company or joined an ensemble or created one.
Because I was for 4 years the artistic director of a company called Big Game, that was there was a company that was started in the very, very late 80s by Anna Shapiro and Tom Bell, and I directed a play for that was successful. Anna went off to graduate school and Tom moved to California, so the board made me artistic director. I was artistic director for 4 years. Now, this was one of those things that's really it was a small operation. There was a few people. We didn't really have, although not without good will involved, there was not really any kind of a successful business strategy. I think we had talent. I don't think we were glorious. But, you know, a lot of this is how to turn it into a business. Mm-hmm. And that's why a lot of companies go and don't go.
Right.
You know what I mean? To create a, this is really vulgar, but there are companies that are very successful artistically because they have met, not just because they're successful artistically, but because they have created a brand name based on artistic success.
Well, that's true for every artist, isn't it? That it's there are people who are hugely talented who are not good self-promoters, and their careers never.
Yeah,
you need both.
We had no way. We didn't know any way, and I did that, and it was really an incredibly unpleasant and incredibly humiliating experience. So I couldn't do that, and I just like to direct. Mm-hmm. I just like to direct plays. You know what I mean? So I just, so the decision was just I couldn't be in one. Now, I've also not been asked. Uh-huh. because as anyone, if you ever were to do follow-up interviews, I am a gigantic pain in the ass. Uh-huh. And I try as hard as I can to get better at not being, but I just am. I'm really obsessive about millions of little things, and I want my way, and I am good and collaborative a good portion of the time, and then I am really, really not. And mm-hmm. that's the, you know what right. I mean? So you have to kind of, I think maybe, you know, I tend to go back places a couple of times. You know, there's theaters that ask me back. There are theaters that ask me back more than twice. But they always need a little time away from me.
Catch their breaths.
Yes.
Recover.
Yes. To get the car alarm-like tone of my voice out of their heads.
Well, you know, I have to say that it's my experience that people who have a really compelling artistic vision can be difficult because, in fact, at the end, it has to be what you believe in, and it's not really collaborative in one way. As a director, ultimately, you're going to... I mean, I guess there are different ways to be a director.
No, I guess that's the case. It's not something that's easy to embrace. And that might be one of those things that separates the men from the boys, as they say. I can't quite embrace being disliked. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm too insecure for that. Mm-hmm. So it becomes very sort of toxic and distracting. And
well, what's an example of a kind of project that you wouldn't feel you could be useful to? What kind of things do you turn down?
I have learned that I cannot direct. I directed a Christopher Durang play called Betty's Summer Vacation. Mm-hmm. I can't direct that kind of absurd comedy where the behavior is so in service to an unrealistic joke. It rings so false, and it doesn't have its effervescence that it wants when I direct that. So I did do a project like that to see what it was like, but mm-hmm. I've learned that I shouldn't direct things like that. Mm-hmm. I don't think I do well with, you know, it's so not my experience to have adventures. I don't, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I did a play that had a lot of violence in it called a lot of very close-up violence in it called Mojo, and I found that to be ultimately so. Since I know that they weren't really getting hurt and they weren't really bleeding, or getting shot in the head, it just started to feel really false to me. So. Mm-hmm. I think I might be stuck in this. No, but he's really making coffee here, and that's more interesting to me. So I guess that'll be my job, you know. I was thinking about it. I was always struggling, especially as I'm getting older, and you start to realize, okay, this might be who I am.
Yeah.
I thought that I was eventually going to become this much bolder, more sort of hedonistic person, that I would be this artist who would take the you know, the road to excess, and that it would lead me to the Palace of Wisdom, and become a lot sort of bolder and sexier and just crazier, and that eventually I was going to do that. And I realized that ultimately I'm this sort of like slightly embarrassed guy. You know what I mean? But what I've come to terms with is, I guess the being slightly embarrassed by everything is my job in life. I'm supposed to do the plays about people who are slightly embarrassed by everything. It's a niche market, but I think it's mine. Well, I think I may have it cornered.
There is that process that we come to a certain point where we just know who we are and mm-hmm. we know who we're not. And it's limiting, but it's also, I think, kind of liberating, because you don't spend any time where you don't belong.
Well, and that's what happens at the end of Come Back, Little Sheba. And that is it's positive. It's the part of the serenity prayer. Serenity. You know what I mean? That's the goal, which is accept the things I cannot change, change the things I can, and to be able to tell the difference. Uh-huh. You know? And I don't think the end of this play is altogether positive.
No.
But I don't think it's altogether negative. I think it's about arriving. I don't think You know, we think that, I think everyone else thinks, serenity is arriving at a place where everything's fine, that everything's great. Uh-huh. And it's not. It's arriving at a place where everything just is,
right.
I think.
Right.
And I don't think they achieve serenity. I think maybe they're closer to it. But the end is just understand. It's accepting certain
yeah.
things. And
yeah.
It's learning to dance with the girl you came with,
uh-huh.
as the old saying
uh-huh.
goes, you know. But it's like anything like that. I mean, and that, I guess, must be the action of life. You know, you just start going around saying, I want that. Can I do anything about that? Let's try a bunch of things. And who you are is based on what your brain tells you is the best way to get at it. You know, they always say that the mark of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And
uh-huh.
and then every time I hear that, I picture the process as a director. I'm in very, very big trouble.
I'll close there by saying okay. that actually the product of that process, in my experience, has been quite wonderful on many occasions, and this is one of them. So
thank you very much.
Thanks so much, David, for all your time.
This is great.